If you would, open up to Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11. I'm hoping we'll get on into chapter 12 today. A couple of things as we went through them last week. If you remember how Jesus wanted to describe this generation of people in the first century, he says, what can I compare you to? And he says, it's like these kids that you see in the marketplace. He says, you have some kids who are playing, singing a funeral dirge, and yet you're not mourning. You have other kids who are playing a flute, and yet you won't dance. And, of course, the parallels there are about John came in, he didn't eat, he didn't drink, and he was the one who was singing the funeral dirge about how they needed to repent, and they didn't change. Many of them didn't change. Some of them did, of course. Then you have Jesus come in, who's eating and drinking, and he feeds all these people, and of course, drinking in terms of, he's not getting drunk, don't think that, but in all those things together, go, here's Jesus who comes, and he's playing the flute about times are good, Jesus is here, and they still won't respond. And so then we got down through these other verses in verse 20. He says, then he began to denounce the cities in which most of his miracles were done because they did not repent. They saw these miraculous things, but they made no change whatsoever. And then we took some time. Of course, he mentions Chorazin, which we know nothing about what took place in that city. And then he brings up Bethsaida. And we talked about how that Philip and Peter and Andrew are from Bethsaida. And yet you see how Jesus is responding to that city by saying, you know what, if the miracles had occurred in Tyre and Sidon, which occurred in you, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. And to go, Bethsaida is spiritually not doing well at all. And it really makes you go back in terms of what he brings up in verse 23. He says, and you, Capernaum or Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? You will descend to Hades. For if the miracles had occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. And to realize, he brings up Sodom, as in Sodom and Gomorrah, from the stories back in Genesis. And to note, didn't God go into Sodom to spare his people? And it just so happened there was only one righteous person in Sodom. And that was Lot. His wife did not respond out of what was good. Later on, his two daughters certainly don't respond out of what is good. And to go, yet God goes in there with these angels to make sure that Lot is given a chance of escape. And Lot responds, and sure enough, he is. He's allowed to leave. And because of him, he and his daughters, of course, in turn get him drunk and have a son. And later on, that son is going to be the lineage father of the Moabites, and realize this is where kind of the origin of the story of Ruth really comes from, because she's a Moabite. So you start to see how things are working together, and you go, and of course, Ruth is in the lineage of who? Jesus himself. And so you realize how these things start to come together. In the same way that God goes into Sodom to bring out Lot, you see how Jesus is there around Bethsaida to pull Philip and Andrew and Peter out so that they can come and learn. Because if they stay there, kind of in this environment, everybody around them is going, we see miracles, but we don't care. We're not going to change. We're not going to turn. So here's something else for you. Just, we're not going to go read through all these things. If you notice in verse 23, he says, and you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? And I want you to think about all the miracles that took place in Capernaum. Matthew chapter 8, right after the Sermon on the Mount, the centurion, remember they're in the area of Capernaum whenever he comes up and he asks, will you heal my servant who is paralyzed at home and fearfully tormented? And Jesus responds, actually, the centurion doesn't actually ask for him to come. He just says, I have a servant. And Jesus says, I'll come. And Jesus already knows what's about to take place, but he says it. And if you remember, the centurion's response is, I'm not worthy for you to come under my roof. I'm a man under authority. And that under authority is a big one. Because he recognizes that Jesus is under somebody else's authority too. And that's a major, major statement. And he says, I tell my servants go and they go. If I'm to come and they come, do this and they do it. He says, all you have to do is say the word. And sure enough, that's exactly what happens. And Jesus points out how marvelous this man's faith is because he recognizes the authority of Jesus. And that's really what faith is. It's recognizing Jesus' authority to keep his promises, to do what he says he'll do, and to be able to overcome whatever the difficulty is at the moment. And you go, here it is. He says, you don't have to come, just say the word. And to go, the people of Capernaum don't get to see that miracle because they're just there to hear it. But then, if we were to turn over to Mark chapter 1, you just see one story after another, after another, after another. And we're going to look a little bit at those because of what's coming in Matthew 12 to get a little bit of a background here. Now, look over at Mark chapter 1. And I want you to think about all these stories that we're going to look at in Mark chapter 1. And we're going to go through them really quick. I don't want to dilly-dally on these things. But Mark chapter 1, if you look down at verse 21, I want you to notice where Jesus comes to. He's already called James and John and Peter and Andrew in the verses before here. But in looking at what's here, verse 20 says, they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath he entered the synagogue and began to teach. So we're in Capernaum, we're in the synagogue, and as these things are going to take place, the next thing that happens as he's there, and notice he's teaching in the synagogue. So they're there listening. They're getting an opportunity. They're not just seeing a miracle. They're actually being taught by Jesus, but still not making a response from what we know in Matthew chapter 11. So, verse 22, they were amazed at his teaching. Interesting. They're amazed, but what? They don't make a move. Now, it's going to bring up later about some people who are obedient, but notice here. He says, for he was teaching them as one having authority and not as the scribes. Just then, there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit. And you go, here it is. I mean, this is hard for me to imagine. To be in the middle of the synagogue assembly, Jesus teaching, and then in the midst of this, someone who's present has an unclean spirit that comes upon them. Now, we're not going to read through it. But through the rest of these verses, all of a sudden, Jesus is going to cast out this unclean spirit in the midst of this synagogue service. And you go, whoa, that would have your attention. Then, as that happens, Jesus casts out this unclean spirit. And then, notice verse 28. He says, immediately the news about him spread everywhere into all the surrounding district of Galilee. So here's this one story that takes place in the synagogue. And to go, in the synagogue, you got more than just a handful of witnesses. You have anybody who is going, striving to be faithful and worship to God and to learn about him, going, here they are. They all see the same thing. Can you imagine if you saw something like that at a worship assembly to go, don't you think you might tell a few people? I think about from time to time, we'll have a situation where somebody will have like a medical emergency and I mean, everybody is talking about it. Well, this is something just the opposite. To have a medical emergency and then it's completely taken care of and then just go right on back to teaching. I mean, can you imagine that? Then as this continues on, verse 29, immediately after they came out of the synagogue, they came into the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. So notice there's the four. Verse 30. Now Simon's mother-in-law, or Peter's mother-in-law, was lying sick with a fever, and immediately they spoke to Jesus about her. And he came to her and raised her up and taking her by the hand, and the fever left her, and she waited on them. Now, here they are. You've already seen a miracle in the synagogue. Now they leave the synagogue, but they're still in Capernaum. They come to Peter's mother-in-law's house, or Simon's mother-in-law's house. She's healed of a fever. And then notice the next aspect, verse 32. And notice this first little phrase. It's very important. When evening came, after the sun had set, why does it give you so much detail about the timing? It has to do with the Sabbath. Here's all these people, and they wait till the end of the day, and you would think that when evening came, that might be enough to understand. But it wants to make sure and make the point about the Sabbath, like, when the sun had set, because when the sun goes down, that's the beginning of the first day of the week. Now the Sabbath is concluded. Now the first day of the week is here. Because remember, and you might think this is really odd about how Jews keep time beginning with darkness, but if you think all the way back to Genesis chapter 1, day 1 begins with what? Darkness. And then God makes light. So you can understand why they count time that way. Then, verse 32 as it continues, they began bringing to him all who were ill and those who were demon-possessed. I wonder how they figured that out. Wonder what they had heard. They had heard about what happened in the synagogue, and then maybe some of them heard about what happened in Simon's mother-in-law's house, but now everybody was just waiting. Can you imagine just, oh, I think about sitting on your front porch and just watching the sun go down and going, how much further until it's time to go? Right? I mean, wouldn't you be thinking that way? So here it is. He says, bring to him all who are ill and those who are demon-possessed, and the whole city had gathered at the door. I mean, if you had anybody who was sick that you knew, wouldn't you take him there? And they knew where he would be in terms of being at Peter's mother-in-law's house. Then, verse 34, and he healed many who were ill with various diseases and cast out many demons, and he was not permitting the demons to speak because they knew who he was. And so you see this over and over again. And then after that takes place, then you're going to see Jesus move on to the next town. But you go, has Capernaum been given ample supply of miracles to see with their own eyes? I mean, they have seen a ton of them. Then notice Mark chapter 2, verse 1. He comes back. When he had come back to Capernaum several days afterward, it was heard that he was at home. There's already been the synagogue man that was healed, unclean spirit. Peter's mother-in-law is healed at home in Capernaum. Then comes all this crowd after the sun had set. Can you imagine if whenever after the sun set, everybody's showing up at your house? And, I mean, it's not like they have outside floodlights they can just turn on. But here everybody coming wanting to be healed. And then all of a sudden, the disciples, Jesus actually goes off to pray in what we didn't read. And then the disciples are like, everybody's looking for you. What are you doing? He's like, look, we got to move on to the next town. Like, don't you know that they want you to heal more people? And Capernaum, I mean, is overflowing with recognition about Jesus can heal you. And so he goes on to the next town, he preaches and teaches, but now he's come back to Capernaum. And then notice, he says, and people heard that he was at home. And he did have a home in Capernaum, by the way, from what we know in Matthew chapter 4. Here he goes on, and then the story comes in, verse 2. And many were gathered together so that there was no longer room, not even near the door, and he was speaking the word to them. It's so cramped and crowded there, and he's teaching. And if you want to read a little bit more about it, Luke chapter 5, verse 17 tells you about the people that are there. People from every village in Galilee, people from Jerusalem, people from Judea. I mean, people have come from way down south now, come up to Capernaum. And all these things are going on, and then comes this story of the man who's paralyzed, and his four friends carry him, and they let him down through the roof. And Jesus says, son, your sins are forgiven. Well, it just so happens there's some scribes and Pharisees that are there who are saying, only God can heal sin. This guy's a blasphemer. They're right that only God can heal, but they're wrong about assuming this is not God in the flesh. You ever get a detail right, but a detail wrong, and it ends up disastrous? Well, here they were. And so you realize, everybody sees this, and then Jesus goes on to say that, so that you can know that I have authority on earth to forgive sin, I'm going to tell this man to get up and walk. And sure enough, he does. And there's not enough room for him to walk in, but there's enough room for him to walk out. And you go, and they leave. So as Capernaum had plenty of opportunities, I mean, over and over and over again, yet there are people there willing to listen to his word, yet not all of them are responding the way they should because of what Jesus is going to say. Now, we're not going to turn over and read it, but in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus goes back home to Nazareth to preach and teach in their synagogue, he tells them, he says, I'm sure you're going to say to me the old proverb, physician, heal yourself. And that's not about Jesus having an infirmity, but saying, heal your own house. It's like if a doctor's child gets the flu, don't they get that taken care of at home? Doesn't the doctor take care of his own family too? But they mean the miracles, and Jesus even goes on to say, it says, you're going to say all the things that you heard that were done in Capernaum, you want me to do here in Nazareth. And he doesn't do it. And you realize Capernaum and Nazareth are some 30 miles apart, and they knew all about what had happened in Capernaum. Yet Capernaum didn't respond right. Now, come back over to Matthew chapter 11. So whenever you see these statements here in verse 23, and you, Capernaum, will not be exalted to heaven, will you? Can you understand why? Given opportunity after opportunity after opportunity and not responding. What does that tell us about the opportunities we're given? If we let them pass by, it's not going to be good. And so we really better take advantage of the opportunities we're given by God. Then he says, you will descend to Hades. And you think about in terms of Luke chapter 16 probably gives the most vivid picture of the Hadean world in terms of the rich man and Lazarus, where the rich man is in torment. And he's even asking Abraham, would you just let him dip the tip of his finger in water so that I can put that on my tongue and not be tormented? And you go, he's saying, look, if you don't make a move toward me, toward Jesus, he says, you're not going to make it. And you need to see that. He says, for if the miracles that occurred in Sodom, which occurred in you, it would have remained to this day. Now, can you think of any miracles that took place in Sodom? Right, the angels rescuing Lot, and if you remember, what did the angels do to all those men who were outside who were trying to break through the door? They were struck with blindness. It's a miracle, but it's a miracle that took away something rather than something being given. It's kind of an interesting side of things. Then, he says, it would have remained to this day. He says, they would have turned if they saw what you saw. So what does that tell you? How bad it is? Then verse 24, nevertheless, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for you. If we're not taking advantage of the opportunities we're given. And I just want you to think about this for a half a minute. We have scripture written down in our own native tongue language. And probably from about the age of, I'm going to say about 6 or 7, we got an education. We received an education to be able to read, to learn to read. Maybe not everybody received the same kind of education. But that God would give us his word written in our language, that we would have been taught how to read. How many excuses do you think we're really going to have? Can we really say, I'm sorry, I didn't know. I didn't have access. I don't think anybody in America much is going to have a leg to stand on. I mean, are we going to say we didn't have time? That one won't work either, will it? And you understand the opportunities we have just on that one plane, let alone other opportunities that we get along the way. And to say here, and this is not a, you know, I think everybody says, you know, I could read the Bible more. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you read it for 24 hours, you'd be pretty tired and you'd be pretty useless the next day. But you realize, are we just investing some time each day to just read through God's word, to look for application for us? And not to pass over the opportunities that we're given, even though they're not miraculous, but they are definitely at the hand of God. Now, yes. Right. And you realize, and now this opportunity is given. I can remember a time, a lady who was in her 40s. And there were two of us that went in together and got her a Bible. And when it was given to her, she cried. She had never had a Bible of her own. And I thought to myself, how in the world could you, I mean, literally, just a couple years ago, you could go down to the Dollar Tree and you could buy an Old Testament and New Testament together for a dollar. Now, it's King James Version, so it takes a little bit more to read through. But to go, can somebody say, I didn't have enough money? I think everybody's run across a dollar at least some point in their life. You know, opportunities in place. Right. 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 And you think about those opportunities, for those who are just listening through the video, in terms of, here's a 13-year-old boy who's at a camp for the blind, and those with other kinds of difficulties, and to go, never heard of Jesus, using language that's not right, and then all of a sudden, by the end of the week, here he is, at least engaging in terms of those things, and to be able to send a Bible. And you realize, here's someone, and he was from Russia, is that what you said? And you realize, here's someone who's not from this country, and you go, and yet here's an opportunity. And it's like another opportunity given. And I'm amazed now in terms of thinking if someone in these days and times is blind, if they can learn to read Braille, they got the whole Bible at their fingertips, literally. And to go through it and to go, what an opportunity. And you start looking through those kind of things, and you see them over and over and over again, how the Lord opens the doors for these opportunities. Then notice verse 25. He says, at that time Jesus said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Notice how hidden it was. Even though it was put right in front of the people in Capernaum and Chorazin and even Bethsaida, right in front of them, they were too smart, too wise in their own mind to humble themselves. And so what happens? The greatest gift ever given is hidden from them. Then he says, but have revealed them to infants. He says, and he's not talking about age here. He's talking about comparison to those who are wise and intelligent. And he's talking about worldly wisdom and intelligence. Because if someone's spiritually wise, what are they going to do with Jesus? They're going to latch on with everything they can to his word and his ways. He says, I praise you that you've hidden it from the proud. Because that's exactly what he had been talking about ever since this child's game. He says, oh, we're too proud to mourn over our sin. We're too proud to celebrate because Jesus is here with us. And you go, and what happens? God hides it from them. Sometimes I'm amazed about how many things are hidden in plain sight. I think about the different logos of things that come and go that you see, and they have little things that are just hidden right inside of them. You can look at them. I remember one time talking to a man who worked for FedEx during the holiday season every year for like 15 years, and I told him about, you know, the FedEx logo has an arrow in it, don't you? And he goes, what are you talking about? And so we pulled it up and I showed it to him. And you should have seen his face. I mean, he had dealt with this stuff for many, many years. And it was still hidden. And you might think, out of all the people, how could that be possible? But to go, the ways of the Lord can be perfectly hidden even though they're right in front of people. And so you see what he's talking about here. He says, and I'm glad that you hide it so that they don't think they're doing what's good and really to blaspheme the name of God in terms of going, oh, you know what, I can act however I want, but as long as I give something to somebody, I'm a pretty good person. Oh, no. Doesn't work that way. Then verse 26, he says, yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. He says, and this is well-pleasing. For hidden things to be hidden. And how many things Jesus spoke about in his parables that have been hidden since the foundations of the world. Remember, Jesus came 4,000 years later to expose things that have been there in plain sight all along. About agriculture compared to the hearts of men. You see it over and over again. Then verse 27, all things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son. And we'll pause there for a second. If you want to really come to know who God the Father is, what is the only way to have that happen? You're going to have to come to know Jesus. You have to come to know the Son. And if you want to really come to know the Son, who are you going to have to come to know? You have to come to know the Father. And if you ever wanted a bigger exclamation point for, is the Old Testament important? Is it valuable? He says, here's where you come to understand who God the Father is. But it really gets revealed when you come and Jesus comes to earth. And you go, this is what really shows who they are. And then you notice the next aspect. He says, no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him, to unveil. This is kind of that opposite term for hidden. He says, these things have been hidden from the wise and intelligent. He says, but now they're being unveiled. But who has to do the unveiling? Jesus does. And if you don't come to Jesus, he says, there won't be any unveiling. Now, and I'll tell you this one. This is one that surprised me. One time I was reading through a book of Greek language, talking about how words were used in the first century, all these kind of things. Guy's just a really, really astute in a lot of these studies. And he came across, and I could show it to you, and he came across in Romans chapter 6, where it talks about baptism. And he starts talking about the way the word is used. He says, you know, it was used like a blacksmith would take hot metals or iron while it's still hot, and he can beat it and beat it into shape and make it really dense and strong. He says, and then they would take the sword, and they would have a big bath, basically, of water. And to cool the sword so that it would change its state from being moldable to now being solid and strong. He says, it would be baptized beneath the water and be brought back up in time, having changed and cooled the metal so that now it was strong and it made a difference in the state of the metal. And he brings this up in the midst of Romans chapter 6, which is about baptism, about being united together with the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus, about changing our state from being outside of Christ to being inside of Christ. And within the next paragraph, he said, but don't think that you have to be baptized to be saved. And I went, he understands the word. He understands where it comes from. And it had other things to go with it too. That's not the only one. And yet the one thing that's missing is the application of the word. And I thought about that verse about God has hidden it from the wise and intelligent. And you go, How can that be? And you go, it's hidden. He can understand words. He can look back at the etymology of words. He can see the usage of the words. But to be able to draw it together, he couldn't do it. Now, you think about these things and go, yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. He says, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. And you go, if the Son's not going to be revealed, if he's not going to want us to be revealed, he says, it's not going to happen. Sometimes this makes us ask further questions like, well, why would Jesus hide this? Start thinking in terms of, remember, God is not partial. If someone's going to respond out of humility and faith, he says, it's always going to be given. But it will be hidden whenever that's not the right response. Same thing that comes along with other aspects of spiritual life. He comes all the way through here and he deals with the proud. He says, they're not going to be given exposure or a revealing of who God is, who Jesus is. Then you get to verse 28, and now he's going to deal with the flip side. He's going to deal with the people who he is going to reveal himself to, who he is going to reveal the Father to. Then notice what he does. Verse 28. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Because it takes humility to recognize that we are broken. And Jesus says, come to me. He doesn't say, I'm coming to you. He says, you're the one who needs to move, not me. He didn't say that with arrogance. But he's saying, I already stand in righteousness. I stand in truth. I stand in love. And I don't stand in arrogance. I stand in humility. And he's about to say that in the next verse. But to go, if you're not willing to come to me, I'm not going to reveal to you who my Father is. Karen? Right. We're the ones who have to walk out of darkness into his marvelous light, not he's coming into the darkness to get us. They go, we have to be the ones who are making this move, because in order for him to be revealed, we're going to have ourselves be dead set on him and nothing else. Then, and notice how he describes it. He says, come to me all who are weary and heavy laden. And as you think about in terms of weariness of going, you are so fatigued and tired of this. Then he says, heavy laden, of going, and you're carrying a big weight, aren't you? He says, you're fatigued, you're worn out, you're wearied from this life, and you're starting to wonder, is there anything better than this? And we carry around these burdens, and specifically the biggest burden is sin. The other burden is darkness, the things that we bring upon ourselves because we don't know any better. And to see it here, he says, and I'll give you rest. He says, I'll take care of you. And this kind of rest is, oh, you can rest in this. And I want you to keep in mind, chapter 12 is going to talk about the Sabbath day. So we're kind of driving toward that kind of rest. Karen. Right. Right. And you think of what takes you to a place of weariness and heavy laden. I want to do it my own way. And it's not getting any better. And instead, it actually gets worse. And you go, I want this to get better. He says, come to me. He says, it's time to make a move. It's time to let go of bitterness. It's time to no longer slander. It's time to be a forgiving people. And you're going, he's calling us out of darkness. And saying, come here. He says, come to me. And he says, all who are weary and heavy laden, I will give you rest. Verse 29. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. He says, take my yoke. And I want you to realize, Jeremiah 27:2 talks about in terms of a yoke, of it being made out of leather and wood. And the idea is about that wooden piece of the yoke that has two harnesses that goes down. And the leather would be what would go underneath for both oxen to be tied into the yoke. And so you see this picture of Jesus saying, take my yoke upon you. And this is perhaps one of my favorite illustrations in all of Scripture, where Jesus invites us to step into his yoke. He says, I'm going to be in one harness. Are you going to get in the other one? He says, come to me. He says, I'll be in the one, and I assume he's going to be in the one on the right. but that's an assumption. But he says, I'm already harnessed into this yoke. Do you want to be harnessed with me? Because I can pull a load you can't pull. And then he says, take my yoke upon you. He says, you're going to have to decide, do you want to get in this yoke with me? Are you going to be too wise and intelligent to step into this yoke with me? Is all this going to be hidden from you? Or are you going to be humble? And then if you notice what he says about his yoke, he says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. And you think about this picture of going, he's not saying I'm far off. He says, just look right there. I'm in the harness next to you. Learn from me how to do this. Imitate my behavior. Now, the Old Testament brings out an idea about saying not to be unequally yoked together. And it talks about the idea of an ox being yoked together with a donkey or a mule. And if you've been out on the farm enough to see both, whenever mules or donkeys pull something, they use leverage. They plant their feet in the ground, and they use their body as a weight that swings forward like a pendulum, so that their weight, being used like a fulcrum in one sense, moves whatever the weight is behind. Oxen, on the other hand, are just strong. And whenever you get two of them in a yoke, they can pull a lot just because of their strength. And so you see, if you have a yoke that has an oxen that's working off of strength and a donkey that's working off of leverage, if they try to work together, they just hurt each other. Because when the oxen is trying to pull with weight, then the donkey falls down to the ground, and now the ox has to pull not only the load, but now he's got to pull the donkey too. And sometimes maybe I'm the donkey. But you look at this picture, and you see why he's saying, look, you can't, and here's the unequally aspect of this. Jesus is always going to walk in what's righteous and holy and in light. And to go, you can't be walking in darkness and in evil and unrighteousness and unholiness and expect him to let you stay in the yoke together with him. He says, take my yoke upon you and learn from me. He says, I'm right here. I'm right here by your side. Then he says, for I am gentle and humble in heart. And so whenever we're the weaker one in this yoke, look at what he does. He says, I'm humble. He says, I'll think of you first. What? Yeah. He says, I know I have the strength to do it all, but I'm going to think of you. Doesn't mean he's going to step away from what's righteous. But he says, I'm concerned about you, and you need to learn that from me. So whenever someone later comes along who's weaker than you, that you treat them the same way I've treated you, with humility and with gentleness. And of course, fruit of the Spirit, love, joy, peace, patience. You go all the way through and get to gentleness. Love. Start saying them too fast. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness. I get it right. My brain has to slow down sometimes. Then, so he hits this here. He says, "For I am gentle and humble in heart." I remember one time being at a Bible camp setting, and there was a young girl there that was a little obnoxious, and so we talked about being humble, and I said, you know, can you know that you're humble? Can you say that you're humble and be humble? And she said, "No, you can't do that." And I says, "Well, let's see what Jesus says." And I mean, everybody's like. And so I try to say it in a gentle way. Try to say it gentle. But you realize, here's this aspect of going, we have to know that we're humble people. It has to be intentional. Because Jesus is was. And we're trying to learn from him. You go, I'm going to intentionally put you ahead of me. I'm going to intentionally, whenever on the inside I'm all reared up, go, all right, I got to remember to be gentle. And so you see these aspects. It says, "For I am gentle and humble in heart." And you need to learn that from me. I tell you, the more you read through the gospel accounts, the more you see the gentleness of Jesus. Now, I mean, he will rebuke somebody. Those disciples that didn't want the children to come to Jesus, they got rebuked. But they got rebuked in a way that didn't scare the kids. It was in a gentle enough way that didn't scare them off. Because then he takes them into his own arms. So, you see how well-rounded this idea is. Then he says, "For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." And he says, verse 28 is kind of about the physical side. Verse 29, the spiritual. So how good is this yoke? It covers both. Then verse 30, he says, "For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Now, this word for easy is where we get our word for kind or kindness. You know, 1 Corinthians 13 about love is patient, love is kind. And it's that kindness that says, I will treat you well, even though you're not treating me well. Isn't that what patience is? He says, there's times we don't always respond the way we should. He doesn't say, all right, I'm going to take you out behind the woodshed. He says, now he will discipline. Don't get so far down that road. But to see this aspect, says, my yoke is easy. He says, I'm going to do this out of kindness with you. He says, and my burden is light. And why is the burden so light? Because he's pulling the load. And whenever you get into the times of life, where you go, man, this is really hard. This is really burdensome. There should be a first question that we think of. Am I doing this according to Christ? Because whenever we do it our own way is whenever it gets really difficult and hard. But whenever we humble ourselves and make sure we're in this yoke together with Jesus, he says, you'll find rest for your souls. He says, I'll give you rest. In terms of what's going on, of the physical burdens that you're bearing, he says, and my burden is light. And I find that is the most wonderful way to attack any difficulty that comes. There's nothing like knowing. It almost reminds me of school. We used to take math classes, and you'd work on a problem, and in the back was every answer to the odd-numbered ones. And I thought to myself, how wonderful is it when you already know the answer, but you have to work yourself through the problem. And to go, Jesus is the answer. Learning to imitate him is the answer. And you can figure out, am I doing this according to him? And then all of a sudden, what happens to the burden? It becomes so much more light. It's about learning to be refined in the same way that those math problems were. You're trying to figure out, how does this work? And then when you figured it out, you're like, oh, no, because that's the answer. I got there. I made it. On to the next one. And you start to realize we've already been given the solution to every problem that man can ever come up with. If we'll just get in the yoke with him. And he'll pull the load. And boy, is that freeing. Through and through. Now, I was hoping we'd get to chapter 12, but as you can tell, we did not. So I'll read verse 1 for you. It says, at that time Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples became hungry and began to pick the heads of grain and eat. He's just talked about rest, verses 28, 29, and 30. Now we're going to start to deal with the Sabbath. But he's going to show you a bunch of people who it's been hidden from, of the people who are there who are wanting to accuse Jesus and his disciples. So keep in mind that where we've been in chapter 11 is going to also indicate where we're going in 12. Sometimes these chapter breaks keep us maybe from looking beyond just the end of the chapter. So we'll keep that in mind as we move forward. All right. Have a good rest of the week.